Mighty beautiful flower arrangement. And we thank the good people that make this possible. Not long ago, someone described conscience as a small, weak voice that is getting smaller and weaker every day. And while this probably isn't exactly true, there are symptoms in society that would indicate that the internal values of the individual are not available to him as often as we would wish. What is conscience? There have been many, many different definitions. One definition that perhaps has some validity is that conscience is the voice of the folk. That is, it is a kind of whisper that descends to us through generation after generation of human experience. It is based upon the evidence of the past. It is based upon a careful consideration of the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule. It is involved in man's total experience of existence. We see around us every day the consequences of wrong action. We observe how our neighbors suffer, how our nations are disturbed, and how our world is troubled. And we begin to put together patterns. We see the causes behind the difficulties that arise. We observe the temperament of our neighbor and decide that to some degree at least, this neighbor has been responsible for the sorrows that have come to him. We find the collective tragedy of disobedience to the common laws of our kind. We recognize the dangers of crime and of violence. We begin to appreciate the increasing problem of alcoholism and narcotics addiction. And we are able to see enough of the consequences of mistakes to create within ourselves a certain subconscious desire to correct these conditions so far as they apply to ourselves. And we are very apt to legislate in the direction of the correction of the common mistakes of living. Conscience, therefore, can be the voice of the old and the voice of the true, and to a sense at least, the voice of the new. It is this continual nagging within ourselves against the intemperances which we realize to be dangerous. This type of folk experience comes down to us through history, through biography, through the testimonies of contemporary people, and through the personal experiences that come to ourselves every day. We know that if we do not discipline ourselves, we will fall into bad habits. We know that if we allow our appetites and our emotions to dominate our conduct, we will likely get into difficulties. So this has become a kind of internal defense mechanism. It is something that has come to us through the five sensory perceptions, has been reorganized and reintegrated in the brain, and has gradually been transferred to the heart as the basis of good living. This perhaps is an oversimplification of this problem, but it certainly does play a part. Conscience is just a series of warnings not to do what others have done and suffered as a consequence. Another definition of conscience, as we get a little more theological, is that in a sense, it is the voice of the divine part of ourselves. Somewhere in the root of each living thing will be found the seal of the laws governing life. Every living thing, whether it be animate or inanimate, wishes to survive. And the seed of survival and the concepts necessary to survival seem to have descended to us with the very bodies and minds that we have inherited. Conscience is therefore that power within man which controls his moral growth, very much as that power in nature which controls the conduct of all other creatures. Just as the plant seeks the light, just as the earth is fruitful, so there are instincts to survive, to grow, to unfold and fulfill. And these instincts are born in us. They are part of our heritage. They are part of the life force which animates us. For with this force comes also certain impulses as to how this force is to be used. The proper use of all energy is survival. The lack of this proper use is self-destructive. So if we wish to assume that every ray of light brings life and hope to living things, so this same ray of light may have within itself the laws guiding its own use and aiming at survival by the correction of all abuse that may arise anywhere in the individual or collective destiny. If in truth this principle of survival is in us, it has laws, it has rules, it has systems of its own. Survival is not an accident. It is not some manifestation of a capricious providence. Survival is the result of the obedience of the principles to which survival is associated. Therefore, the will to be happy, the desire to be healthy, the hope for peace and harmony, the intention to do those things which will secure the maximum benefits, these impulses seem to be innate. They are probably in every cell and every blood drop that makes up the human corporeal constitution. They are in everything that exists, because existence continues, unfolds, and survives according to rules. It is not a series of accidents. In an effort to cooperate with the laws of existence, men attained or sought to attain some knowledge of these laws. And all the history of the search for realities has been impelled by this belief that the search will end in security, that the various factors and forces that make up destiny can be and are influenced by conduct, and that conduct itself is the secret of man's securities and happiness. This would carry the idea that there is a certain conscience in nature, that every natural law and natural force has something to do with the principle of cause and effect. And the principle of cause and effect tells us and reveals to us that unless we set up the proper causations, we cannot expect the securities we hope. Now, the search for the rules has dominated us for thousands of years. And the wisest and noblest of human beings have been dedicated to an effort to discover the rules governing life and the development of a character within living things by which these rules will be obeyed. That obedience to rules becomes the most important law for man. This, of course, naturally leads us to another problem. If there be rules, who made them? What is the source of these laws? Are they something that is innate in matter? Are they something that in themselves are eternal? Had they no beginning? Is there no intelligent principle behind them? Is it simply a series of accommodations to the unknown? Many thoughtful persons will not accept this. They do not believe that there can be laws without a lawmaker. They do not believe there can be an orderly existence unless the source of that existence is also orderly. And it has occurred to a great many who have studied human behavior that unless there are rules, there will be chaos. the individual without some pattern to live by seldom lives well. In the same way, a universe that has no pattern for its own existence can become involved in innumerable catastrophes. And it is the opinion of many learned persons who have studied the universe in some detail that without a presiding genius, without a sovereign principle or law, we would not even be problem today because we would no longer exist. We would have perished long ago in the combustion of stars and the collisions of planets. We would have had no orderly defense for our needs or for our joys and sorrows. We realize that there is a strange interlocking of principles and processes all through the universe, and that these, in turn, are all aimed at providing a reasonable pattern for the existence of existing things. Buddha declared the universe to be a vast commonwealth. It was a vast integration, a kind of strange socialized cosmos in which all of the principles work together for the common good, and all of these principles are subjectively aware of what constitutes the common good. Thus it would follow that, as Lord Bacon pointed out, that we cannot hope to have a mentally integrated universe without a mind. We cannot have life without universal life. We cannot have thought without universal thought behind it. We cannot have actions unless these are made possible through the dynamics in the universal pattern itself. So this brings with it the concept that conscience is something bestowed with natural law, that it is the true explanation of order, that it is the principle by which we exist as long as we obey, and obedience in this case is conformity to a universal purpose. At the seat of this universal purpose is, therefore, the universal purpose maker. The universe is either purposed or it is not purposed. If it is not purposed, nothing is important. If it is purposed, everything is important. As we obviously note every day, things are important. Therefore, the power that creates them must have importance, must have significance, must have the power and the authority to enforce the patterns by which the universe exists. We also come to know, gradually, that this universe is much more complicated and far vaster than we have ever imagined. It goes out into infinitudes of light years. It is inhabited by worlds, races, and nations of stars. It is constantly in motion. It is constantly evolving or manifesting. Every motion and manifestation is orderly. And every process is so exact that man has been unable to discover actually any conflict in this great pattern of things. What we call conflict, we are beginning to realize, is simply a form of order and law which we do not comprehend, that is beyond our immediate or approximate knowledge. So the second theory of conscience is based upon the fact that it is based upon an allegiance of the individual form of life to the parent form, to the causal form, to the laws and rules governing the entire, and that the individual, as part of an entirety far vaster than himself, cannot set up an independent pattern of life in a world that is controlled by an absolute law. Conscience, then, can be said to be constantly counseling us to obey the principles upon which survival depends. Conscience is the internal recognition of a universal plan, of a divine power at the source of that life, and a divine edict to which we must give allegiance whether we wish to or not. This brings into the pattern the problem of deity. Today there are many atheistic states and nations There are a great many probably private atheists. But the total body of mankind is overwhelmingly, internally motivated by spiritual or psychical forces. The individual, by experience, cannot find the universe of the atheist. He finds that a little knowledge inclineth his mind to atheism, but greatness of knowledge bringeth it back again to God. The more we know about the universe, the fewer atheists we will have. It is ignorance of principles that makes atheism possible. It is the fact that we have not gone far enough into the realities to outgrow the illusions which have arisen in our own minds. So to create a conscience-governed universe, we must have a universal conscience. This conscience is revealed to us largely through scriptural writings in which deity, in one form or another, through its prophets, through its saints and sages, is made to proclaim its own purposes, to make manifest its will, and bestow upon mankind the laws suitable for the survival and fulfillment of the divine plan. This constitutes, of course, another problem for many thinkers. It is possible to some that there may be a universal mind that is not necessarily identical with a deity as we understand God today. The universal mind may be inherent. The laws may be actually eternal in the substances by which they manifest themselves. This could be true of certain things, but it brings in certain other conflicts which we are not able to understand. Among mortals, wherever mind exists, conflict exists. The intellect is competitive. The intellect is forever imposing itself upon other intellects. It is constantly challenging other aspects of itself. In the large pattern of things, there is very little conformity in mental processes. Specialization has resulted in the mind being trained to be competitive. It has been trained to compare and to find many odious comparisons. It has been trained to search for differences and to distinguish things by their separateness. Therefore, the mind by itself has never been able to prove that it could maintain a universal purpose, any more than it can be proved that mentality, as it has evolved among human beings, has resulted in a final brotherhood of man. Mentality has caused more division than any other factor that we know. Mentality on a cosmic level, therefore, might be implied as causing divisions. Things by mentality may be created, but this creative process ends in conflict. One form of life in constant conflict with another. Now, while this condition is notable and inevitable on a material level, where mind is involved in various degrees of form, it is inconceivable that the conflict of mind could regulate the cosmos. It would then set one cosmos against another, and Star Wars would be a reality. As a matter of fact, however, such wars in space are not known to really exist. And the moment we get above a certain level of intellection, the whole concept of war collapses. The more the mind meditates upon realities, the less conflict there is. But unfortunately, most minds do not meditate that deeply. And the result is the world is in confusion so far as human governments are concerned. But there is no evidence that this confusion extends into the universe. We find, therefore, that most of the troubles of humanity arise with humanity, and most of these troubles arise in the effort of the individual to play deity on some level of function for which he is not qualified. Thus, we have another point of view in connection with conscience, that conscience is something inside of man that is constantly affirming the importance of obedience to the grand plan of things. A conscience that goes far beyond the simple brotherhood of man, but includes it. A conscience that goes on to a brotherhood of worlds, a brotherhood of galaxies, in which everything that exists is there for a purpose and is in relationship to everything else that exists. Now, in more recent years, we have had a psychological approach to the problem of conscience. And this psychological approach is a kind of compromise. It has to do with the fact that conscience is the consequence of the various conflicts within personality itself. That the individual's conscience is born of his own neuroses, born of his own introversions and extroversions, born of his own acceptances and rejections, and that therefore conscience is completely and entirely personal. And what one person does with a good conscience would afflict the conscience of another person. This, again, has some interesting factors involved in it, but we cannot take it as a final statement of our subject. Assuming that conscience is the result of what has happened to us and how we have reacted to it, it would seem very obvious that because our actions are equated by our minds and experienced by our emotions, that conscience would then simply be the voice of our own total psychic experience. It would have no definite relationship to the experience of any other person. Each may have a conscience of this kind, but this conscience originates in the complex of his own nature. It results from his own attitudes toward things. Conscience, therefore, seems to be able to impel one person to a crime of vengeance because he believes his cause is just. Another individual with a different integration under a similar provocation decides that conscience is telling him to forgive his enemy and to continue to do good to those who grievously afflict him. Each person trying to fulfill his own conscience may cause this conscience to appear to be himself. And under this pressure of this selfness of his own conscience, all kinds of strange phenomena result. This type of conscience has much to do with the selection of vocation. It has to do with the management of a home. It has to do with the training of children. It has to do with the whole structure of individual and family moralities. Conscience is therefore something that justifies an attitude which we have already decided to accept. A conscience, then, is what we feel at our present state of growth in the reaction to the circumstances of our environment. Conscience is therefore to be found behind nearly everything from Adolf Hitler to St. Francis of Assisi. It is always what we believe, what we think, what we feel we should do under a certain condition. Actually, of course, this type of conscience is subject to growth. A conscience based entirely upon our own personal complex is therefore subject to modification and renovation. A change of attitude will therefore give us a new level of conscience. The individual who outgrows certain areas of selfishness finds his conscience now applauds unselfishness. The individual who has been a kind of Robin Hood, who has been a kind of defender of the people, and may have achieved this defense through ulterior motives and violence, will gradually be modified and recognize that his intention to be helpful must be supported by a constructive method of achieving the help he wishes to spread around among others. So here we have a psychological approach to it, and this we do encounter very frequently in working with people. One of the interesting things that this type of conscience brings into focus is a conflict within the person himself. There appear then to be two levels of conscience arising from a separation due to personality pressures. A simple example of this is the individual who says, I know, I should, and I do believe in forgiving my enemies, but don't ask me to forgive Mr. Jones. This is different. The mind then builds in a strong case as to why we should not forgive Mr. Jones. And this case gradually converts us so that we may go out and tell others to forgive their enemies, but we must not be expected to forgive ours, because this is all different. Our own case is unique, curiously just, and against the pressure of non-forgiveness, we have no adequate resistance. After a time, perhaps, when we have experienced the misfortunes and tragedies of unforgiveness, we may finally come to the point where we decide to forgive our enemy, to get it over with, and try to reconcile. This period of reconciliation seemingly comes nearly always as more solutional than the continuance of the grievance. Therefore, we find a certain peace or a certain release when we get over negative or destructive attitudes. But for many persons, this type of release is very, very difficult to attain because of the tremendous emphasis upon self. This brings the ego, or the personal self, into focus as a factor in conscience. The individual has his own personal integration. He is a self-centered human being. To him, the most important thing in the world is himself. That he shall achieve the fulfillment of his own purposes becomes the major reason for life. While this remains, conscience is defeated. And yet in its place is a pseudo-conscience which justifies all and makes all these ambitions perfectly proper. The case in point, perhaps, is a certain man who in a very dishonorable, vicious manner accumulated a huge fortune. After he had accumulated it, he began to realize the penalty that he had to pay in order to gain what he had. Little by little, this pressure of what he has becomes too heavy a burden, and there is a change in his own internal life. This individual in later years may give away his fortune or devote it entirely to benevolent purposes. He wishes to get rid of the conscience hurt that has developed as a result of his previous conduct. Usually only experience, time, and suffering will bring about this type of reformation. But it does arise when the individual discovers the negative consequences of the negative causes which he himself set in motion. Under this type of pressure, we find sometimes that the worst sinner becomes the greater saint, because finally we can no longer endure the conflicts set up by the consequences of conduct that was basically dishonest in the first place. This type of conscience problem has resulted in numerous benevolences in which the individual seeks to restore his own comfort of inner life by various humanitarian acts and philanthropies which will compensate for his personal selfishness. Selfishness and self-centeredness, of course, block conscience always. The Greeks pointed this out very clearly, that the soul has very little opportunity to express itself as long as the strength of the ego remains unbridled or unrestricted. The ego in the individual is based upon the simple fact, I want what I want. Also, it is there to justify getting what we want. And if someone questions this as being a proper way of growth, the individual will then point out that everyone else is doing it that way, and therefore he shall continue. In other words, he uses the delinquency of society to justify his own personal compromise of principles. Locked in this self-centeredness, therefore, as long as the individual is concerned primarily only with the satisfaction of his own ambitions, he can never actually obey or receive the inspiration of inner conscience or consciousness.
Now, another phase of this subject comes in with the doctrine of the human soul. Most ancient peoples believed that spirit and matter are bound together by a psychic factor in all living creatures. This psychic factor is a blending of the divine and the material. It forms the bridge between the natural man and the man of God. It becomes the link by which heaven and earth are bound together in a benevolent conspiracy. The soul, therefore, in man is variously discussed. To some, the soul is a kind of new entity that is born in man but never dies. It is the immortal mortal. It has a beginning but no end. And this in itself is scientifically difficult to explain, and scientists have given it up. But it is still true that in terms of some theologies at least, soul is referred to as a one-ended stick. It is something that begins but does not end. In Christian mysticism, the soul represents a kind of psychic body. It is the body of Christ in man. It is the embodiment of the Christ principle of redemption within the nature of the mortal being. The soul is therefore constantly seeking the growth of the person. And in the problem of evolution with man, there comes a time of transition in which the leadership of man himself, his own leadership over his life, must be transferred from the mind to the soul. To most mystics, the soul has been seated in the heart. And in most Oriental religions, the soul seeking is called the heart doctrine. It is the gradual victory of a superior power beyond man's formal, physical, material integration. The soul is something that lives and grows and exists within the individual. The soul is nourished according to the virtues of life. The soul grows when all positive elements of experience are built into it. The soul becomes a measuring stick. It becomes a kind of thermometer which tells the condition of the total being. The soul in the Christian mysticism is often referred to as the golden wedding garment, which man must wear when he goes to the bride of the marriage of the Lamb. The soul is therefore something that is another kind of body, which is built out of character and conduct, that unfolds through ages, that passes from one embodiment to another, and is constantly unfolding. It is Emerson's Oversoul. It is this mysterious power that grows upon the beauties and virtues of life. It is based upon man's gradual unfolding experience of the importance and significance of good in his own career. The soul has been assumed to be the seat of the arts, even as the mind has been of the sciences. And all material things finally come under the dominion of the soul power that is locked within them. Now, there is a belief which is long held that the soul was once more powerful in man than it is today, its power residing in the fact that the soul became more and more limited as the mental nature developed greater and greater individuality. The soul is not nearly as individual as the mind. The soul is a collective. The soul is a communal thing, whereas the mind is very highly objective and very highly personal. The Greeks held that the soul had to be helped. The soul is a kind of spiritual infant born in the manger of man's physical body, surrounded by the beasts which are his animal appetites and instincts. And this soul must be nurtured. It must be guided. It must be released. Man cannot actually add to the soul as a principle. What he calls helping the soul to grow really means helping the release of the soul power through the various vehicles of the personality. Growth is therefore for the soul release. unfoldment, the gradual coming forth of that which is better through the instrumentality of human effort and dedication. The dedication to the soul becomes the power which gives it nutriment. The soul is fed by the virtues of humanity. Each individual feeds the soul by his own dedications, by his allegiances to principles, by his recognition of the unity of life, the beauty of living, and all of the related matters. The soul rejoices in great art, great music, and most of all, it rejoices in great virtues. It also comes just as easily and just as immediately to the most simple person, for it is simply the gradual release of the best part of himself through the rest of himself. The soul is a link, then, between an individual with his personal attitudes and the universal principle from which he is suspended. It is the effulgent blossom with its roots in heaven. It is the rose of the West mystic, and it is the lotus of the East. It is the symbol of the release of that part of man which is the best part of himself. But it is built gradually over a long period of time by the gradual accumulation of constructive achievement. It is enriched, it is ennobled, it is released into expression by the effort of the individual to grow. He is not actually bestowing something upon the soul any more than food actually creates the body. But food maintains the body, and good maintains the soul, giving it ever greater expression and greater spheres of manifestation. The release of the soul was therefore the great work of antiquity and of alchemy. It was the gradual regeneration of the individual from within himself, only possible because there was within himself, forever and always, the seed of his own regeneration. This concept is gaining greater popularity today also, especially as we begin to recognize the fallibility of the mind upon which we have based so many of our conclusions. That the mind by itself is suitable of achieving the ends we desire is now regarded as unlikely. It is not being justified by any experience that we have. Now, the idea of the world soul is involved also in the great triads of universal religion. In the Platonic and Socratic school, we find the great trinity of divine power described as the One, the Beautiful, and the Good. The One represents the spirit, or divine power, locked within man. The Good is the representation of conduct, morality, action, the performing of those deeds which are good. And between the One and the Good is the Beautiful. And the Beautiful was the second person of the ancient triad and is the messianic principle in Christianity. The Beautiful is represented under the term of love. It is the glorification of all that is constructive, idealistic, and noble in the composition of man. It is the release through man of the God-man within himself. It is the release through the personality of the psychic center of adoration and veneration, which is natural to all created things. The soul, therefore, becomes, in a sense, the individual savior of each person in whom that soul has residence. This redemption from within was the essential principle of the doctrines of Behme, the German mystic. For to him, the soul was like a little seed planted in the heart, which would grow into a great tree, and the branches of which were the medicines for the healing of the nations. The soul is something that is a kind of second birth. For the body is born from the womb, and the soul is born from the heart, says the German mystic. And this is very largely the basis of conscience. Conscience is actually, to the mystic, the divine soul in himself revealing itself and impelling him to conduct consistent with its own nature. The sorrowing soul is the soul that is afflicted by the wounds of materiality. This is the part of the symbol in the early Christian church of the Mater Dolorosa, the Mother of God with the seven wounds, the seven wounds being the seven deadly sins. Therefore, the soul is wounded by the evil that is done by the person. The soul is afflicted by the burden of destructiveness which arises in the personality. The soul is constantly counseling for the recognition of those virtues and those values which bring peace and happiness to the individual. So as we come on down now to the personal conduct of people and the problems and the difficulties with which we are all faced every day, we know that growth is the gradual victory of soul power over brute force. The soul is the leader which takes command when the mind recognizes its inadequacy. When we leave this life in the hands of the mind, we are in trouble. On the other hand, the mind, once it has been redeemed by the soul power, is regenerated and becomes the most powerful instrument for good that is possible for man to use. The conversion of the individual is really a threefold process. First, the body must be converted to the rules of common sense and integrity and its needs met. The heart must be converted away from its personal passions to an impersonal compassion for all that lives. And the mind must be converted so that it is no longer the instrument for the gratification of self-seeking, but becomes what it was intended to be, the instrument for the instruction of the whole world and the instruction of the mind, the sharing of the knowledge of the soul. The soul is therefore the ruler of the mind. And when this rulership is compromised or denied, the life begins to drift into problems. If you have been brought up in the average Western home in the last century, you will realize that the conduct of modern man is showing serious deteriorations. And this means that the conscience, the collective conscience of the public, has been gradually blocked by negative factors. Quarrel, in his Book of Emblems,